Good afternoon, everybody. We are going to start our April board meeting. And the first topic that we are going to discuss is primary financial statements. And I give the floor to Michelle.
Thank you. So we'll start with paper 21A on management performance measures. Now, at our last meeting, there were still some concerns by the board about our proposals and a desire for us to bring a more simplified proposal to a future meeting. Paper 21A aims to address those concerns and provide a clearer proposal. In particular, it's worth highlighting that past meetings, our proposals have included requirements about the presentation of management performance measures subtotals in the statement of financial performance. And there were concerns about how these proposals interact with the current requirements in IS1 for additional subtotals. Now, our revised proposals for this meeting only focus on disclosure requirements in the notes, and so they don't affect the requirements for subtotals. Now, the main changes to our proposals that we presented in February are listed in paragraph 36. And the first question for this meeting follows that paragraph. Before moving to the first question, do board members have any questions or concerns on our revised proposals for management performance measures?
I think the paper is an improvement on what we had last time, and I think it does address some of the things that we raised, which is great. My overarching concern is that I still don't want it to look like we're requiring people to go and create a management performance measure, and I think that can be addressed from the drafting. Still, when I read it, it reads like everybody does this when we know everybody doesn't. And I also don't like any sense that these management performance measures are somehow superior or equivalent to IFRS measures, which are the basic framework that we work with. So subject to those kind of comments, I appreciate the clarity that has been presented to us and the improvements that are there. So I suppose my concerns could be addressed through drafting and through the way we state what we're requiring, given that I do have this overarching concern that we shouldn't be requiring people to do MPMs when they don't already, and we shouldn't be implying that somehow IFRS is deficient and we must have these things. Thank you.
Chuck.
Thank you. Trial. Have you ever thought about deleting IS1 paragraph 85 completely? Because we are now inventing MPM, and then some will be shown on the face of the statement of financial performance, but some are not. It's only in the notes. So there would be some big gap between the those are on the face, those are not on the face. So some are very prominent and some are not. So then if we prohibit showing MPM on the profit and loss statement, then in a sense everything is in the notes. So then we can say that the prominence, in terms of prominence, they are equal. However, that could be a breach of IS 1, paragraph 85 and 85A. So now we have more line item in the paragraph 81A, and that could somehow alleviate the necessity of paragraph 85. So in terms of consistency, there is a possibility just simply abolish paragraph 85 and strengthen paragraph 81A, and then it should come up with, you know, a very rich note about MPM. Have you ever thought about such kind of things? Just, I'm saying just drive. I'm not saying this is a nice way, but
our proposals for this meeting focus only on the note disclosure, and we know that we will need to probably go back and have a look at paragraphs 85 and 85A as a separate exercise, and it may be something to consider. I mean, we hadn't looked at deleting paragraph 85 because I think the idea that it's difficult for us to envisage all of the subtotals within a statement of financial performance that would be useful to all users. And I think paragraph 85 gives us a sort of catch-all, if you like, for situations where a subtotal would undoubtedly provide relevant information. And that paragraph effectively says, well, you should provide that if you do. So I think 85A serves a useful purpose, and we hadn't considered deleting it.
Okay, just can I follow? So I agree with your comment. So in that case, the problem we need to address is the difference of prominence between those who are neatly fit in the face and those who are not. So that is the thing we need to address. And maybe if there is a big difference in terms of prominence, then that may cause the issue, some issues. So we have to focus on addressing the difference of prominence.
Sure. I'm glad Rachel said what she did in response to the question on paragraph 85. And I know TAC wasn't suggesting it, but rather asking a question. But I think this is sort of one tool we've got in our armoury and a standard which doesn't have much specificity, and investors, a lot of them, when I talk to them, at least seem to be worried about disaggregation rather than too much. And I think this paragraph is the one thing we've got to help. So, but focusing on your proposal, which is focusing on the notes, I agreed with the comment that Anne made about not creating some sort of implication that somehow there were other measures that were better than our IFRS measures, which I think is a wording point, in particular on 1.1. I was interested, though, in her observation about whether it was appropriate that we, if I understood correctly what Anne was suggesting, I'd be interested to get your reaction to that. This idea that, as I understand it at the moment, we're saying, tell us what it is that you consider to be the key metric that you use when you explain performance. We hope that plenty of people will say that's an IFRS number and they'd disclose it and say it's an effectively it's an IFRS number. But if it's not, then there's additional requirements to help explain it, which is slightly different to what Anne's suggestion was, because I think she was saying, well, if they're using an IFRS number, they don't need to sort of highlight that that's the one they're using necessarily, right?
I think with what we've got to so far and what we're looking at in question one, I think we lead with an explicit statement that their primary measure may well be, yep, is or yep, should be, or, you know, something about IFRS as the primary measure, and these other things are additional or supplementary. So I'd actually want to lead with that somehow that affirms to people that we do expect to see IFRS measures as we know them now as primary measures.
And if we clarified that, would you then be happy that everybody sort of says what the measure is, but we've made it clear that, you know, the expectation would be that sometimes or often even that could be an IFRS number, then you'd be happy with it? Because I quite proposals as they are. I think it's quite a good, neat way of interacting with 85 as well, because it's not really getting on the toes of 85. It's a different approach, and I like that.
I'd like to see a statement up front that said we would expect for most people their primary measure is an IFRS measure. However, if you wish to provide a supplementary one, away you go. A really, really confirming and affirming for other thousands of companies that don't do this, we're not, just make it really
but
clear.
But I don't think the majority of companies see IFRS as just uses IFRS.
No, but there are many companies that don't produce an EPM, and I wouldn't want to imply to those that they should now start
that
doing
that
it.
Is the
yeah. And it may be they don't do it because they read their regulators. They think their regulator doesn't want to see it.
I agree with, and I think we can do a lot with the wording. I already offline gave some suggestions to the staff. I think this term best communicates is sort of inviting companies to give a competitive key measurement relative to IFRS. And you could also say help communicate other possibilities. But the way it's worded now, it's bound to lead to a lot of misunderstanding, I think. Mary?
broadly supportive of the staff proposal summarized in question one. I wanted to check a couple of things and maybe make one suggestion, a slightly different way of responding to Anne's concern. Let me do the two questions first. First of all, paragraph 14, when I look at the list and your identification of A, business profit, and B, profit before financing, investment, and tax, I think the only difference between this is integral associates. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think for the benefit of broader audience following it, it's hard to keep in mind what each of those distinctions are, you know, the ones that are new. It might be helpful to have a reminder of that just so we all know what we're signing up for. And second is something I think it's a wording point in the appendix when you're talking about changing MPMs, and I am just clearing away kind of the rubble first, changing the MPMs. It makes it sound as if you can only change it if there's a change in IFRS standards. And while I agree that, I'm looking at page 21, paragraph F, sub F, in appendix C. While I agree that it should be, our expectation should be it's rare that it isn't a flavor of the month kind of thing for what is an MPM, I think saying you can only change it if it's there's a change in IFRS standards is too narrow, because I'm going to go back and may not feel I'm doing it right, but try to channel Martin's earlier comments on some of this, which is if the whole point of a management performance measure is to show management's perspective, if management's perspective changes, it doesn't make any sense to force them to continue to present something as their measure of performance if that's not what they're using. So that leads me to my response to Anne's concern in the wording question one, which is, maybe the point that we're trying to make is, you know, the board has concluded that the statement of profit or loss is the primary measure of performance, something we have exact words we just used in the CF that we published last month. However, to give users of financial statements additional insight into management's perspective, an entity shall identify whether it has an additional measure of performance that it uses. Something, you know, it's a requirement. We want an affirmative statement about whether there's something that you use. It's not you must have them or we expect you to have them, but, you know, an affirmative statement that you identify whether you use one of the things on the P&L or whether you use something else, or you can say, you know, we use internal, more disaggregated measures and, you know, that any one of those is an acceptable to me response, but it's just saying tell us what you do, and but then I think all of the rest of the, you know, this flows, and I think that really is a wording tweak in matter of emphasis rather than a disagreement with what you're outlining. The one point that is potentially a disagreement, but it may be just a frustration, is the language in 19 paragraph 19 about columnar presentation. You just say, in December we considered but did not favor. I thought we'd absolutely rejected for management performance measures. And I think we need to get clarity about whether it's allowed for any other purpose. I'm not advocating a specific outcome, but I think when we go out with any consultation on this, we have to be clear what our views on columnar presentations are. Not at all, permitted but not required. Required, and do the requirements that we have in IS1 now for additional line items, you know, the amounts measured, properly labeled, you know, calculated consistently. If we permit or require columnar for anything, do those same requirements apply to the columnar disaggregation as would apply to a horizontal disaggregation? So that's a tidy up. Just to say once more, support what you're proposing here.
Nick?
I'm broadly in support of the proposals as set out. I think, and I'm happy with the emphasis that Anne talks about as well in terms of saying that, you know, there's a sort of hierarchy here. Just a small point on columns in terms of Mary's. I asked someone recently about use of columns in the UK, which I think are probably one of those markets where they've been used most. And the sense is that the use is in decline. Generally, the only place that they'd like to be retained is when you've changed your year end. So if you go from, let's say, September year-end to a December year-end, it was felt that would be useful. Still be allowed to have columns under those circumstances.
That to me doesn't feel like a columnar presentation.
No, but that was
disaggregation of...
So that was the only concern that was expressed.
Gary?
Thank you, and by the way, to the staff, I thought very readable papers and on point responsive. I agree with a lot, but some things I don't agree with. But let me just test understanding. You go to page 21, and it's the table. And if I read across the top line, possibly for investing, financing, and tax, and I go to the right-hand column, I see adjusted 1950. Would your expectation be that's a number I would be seeing in the face of the income statement? Is that how to interpret this?
No, that would be the management performance measure reconciliation. That was what the disclosure was intended to show.
But
that would be the disclosure in the notes, just to show the difference between the IFRS subtotal and the management performance measure.
But, okay, that I understand, but would there be anything we're saying in here that said that number could not be on the face of the P&L, just at revenue, some sort of cost, subtotal that's 1950, and then these three line items below it. It's hard to focus solely on the disclosure without having a vision of what the primary statement looks like. So would there be anything we're saying that the 1950 could not be on the face of the P&L as its own subtotal?
It could be in there if it would fit in our proposed structure, but because of the requirements we're developing for the by function by nature.
I appreciate that limitation, but the answer I needed to hear was yes, it could potentially be in there, you know. And
I think if it fits in the structure point is an important one because, for example, the restructuring charges is likely to be a combination of different natures of things. Amortization of intangibles is nature and share-based payment expenses are nature. The restructuring one doesn't really seem to fit into a nature-type flow. So I think something like this would probably be quite difficult to actually fit in.
Well, if restructuring costs was all severance costs, that's kind of a by nature, you know, type thing. And and again, I appreciate maybe it can't always fit, but I did hear is it could fit, you know, at least in certain circumstances, right? Now, if I didn't label that subtotal a key measure, but I just said, oh, it's just important, I'll have paragraph 55, 85 or 81A or something, it could still do that, could you not?
Yes, you mean if this isn't identified, if this fits in the proposed structure but not identified as a performance measure, it may still be meet the requirements of additional subtotals.
Of 81 or 85,
yes.
Yeah. Because I think that's one of the key things, you might have to, kind of like hedging, you have to designate a number or a line or result as a key measure. That's central to all these things. And I do agree with Mary is that there's got to be some persistence or duration associated with that number, but it does change. And as business strategies change, as CEOs change, and so on, or as just competition changes. So, and I don't know if we'd want to think of that as a voluntary change in accounting principle or something, but I think in time is we probably have to answer that question either affirmatively or negatively, you know, with some discussion document there is, if that designation changes, what is it?
Well, actually, the part about the measure being consistent period on period, the part Mary's pointed to is a bit from the discussion paper, the pod discussion paper. Whereas we had a slightly different, we came to a slightly different requirement in Appendix B, which is just if there is a change in how the management performance measure is calculated, that there would need to be sufficient explanation. But the part about it being consistent from period to period was actually just something that we used as background consideration from the POS discussion.
Oh, by the way, I agree it should be consistent period to period, and if for whatever reason you change, it should have reclassifications, you know, to make them comparable. But I think the question will come, is that a change in presentation, a change in principles, a change in application or principle? And I don't have a hard feeling which it is. I just think in any paper that comes out, we're going to probably either answer the question or we're going to be asked to answer the question with comment letter feedback. Okay, thank you.
Chen Wu.
Thank you. I generally agree with your recommendation, and the paper is very written and very logical. There is no flaw, seems to me. So that one clarification on paragraph 15. You are considering some expanding the list with some additional subtotals like gross profit, profit before taxation, and so on. So let me ask that if this gross profit is not on the list, it's not included in the list, then this gross profit must be disclosed in the notes, not presented on the face, right?
But it could still be shown on the face, but for the purpose of this requirement, the measure that management had identified as best communicates performance was gross profit, then that would be under our proposals would be a management performance measure, because it's not in the list that we would include in paragraph 81A. But those proposals themselves wouldn't affect whether something goes on the face. That gross profit could still be an additional subtotal that would be on the face in accordance with the current requirements in item 1.
What's so the key measure?
This might be related to tax question, maybe. If we keep that paragraph 85, then we can add more subtotals on the face. But based on your recommendation, if any subtotals that are not in the list, then everything goes to the notes, right?
No, they could still be disclosed on. They could still be presented on the face if they fit the proposed structure. So our proposals can be thought of as completely separately from what's the current requirements for additional subtotals.
Yeah, I think, actually, I'm concerned about it, but let me just focus on one thing so I'm not too vague. I really just want to go back to Anne's concerns about, A, we're not imposing, the majority of entities don't disclose these at the current time in their elsewheres, and that real concern was superior equivalent to IFRS. And when I was reading this, I sort of went back and thought generically about information systems. And if you have an information system and you want to add a new item, one of the questions I'd ask generically is, do you intend this to be a substitute or a complement? And I sort of tried to run that test through. And so, and I think they lead you to kind of different places. But let me just ask the question, when you guys conceive of this, do you see these things as substitutes or complements?
Complements.
Supplements.
That wasn't a choice.
I think, personally, I absolutely do compliments, and I think if we look at conceptual framework, there's a paragraph in there somewhere. It's kind of the relevant one. It kind of goes to what Anne was saying earlier. I'll just read paragraph. This is the new one, or the not the new. It's the new, the relatively new one. Paragraph 716, it says, that statement contains a total for profit or loss that provides a highly summarized depiction of the entity's financial performance for the period. Many users of financial statements incorporate that total in their analysis either as a starting point or as the main indicator. And I think starting point's important, because if we retain what the conceptual framework says, then this should be complementing. Starting point remains the same. I think it goes to Anne's concern that we not elevate or even make equivalent. So I just kind of raise that. The other thing I'll say, though, is if we then follow them to their logical conclusion and how we present it, if you think about a pure substitute, you might think of the question somebody occasionally asks, if you were stuck on a desert island, which piece of music would you want? That's clearly kind of a substitute. You know, everybody's competing. And you could substitute, which financial performance measure would you want? And we've sort of posed the question. We've sort of posed the question on the deserted island way. But if we really want to be a complement, then I think we have to be a bit more careful. I'll make the other statement about complement, which is where I think we need to be, is best in the complement world is different than best in a substitute world. When you look at a complement world, you look at the existing information, what you add, and then you put them together and say, is this the best you package? So it's when you look at the complement, it's what it adds to the package. It's not a standalone comparison. So there's a kind of a philosophical principle that's going to take you potentially different places. So I just kind of wanted to highlight that. And I think I think it also goes really to what Anne said, is if we think about it as complements, we won't do the two things she warns us of. And I think maybe it may sharpen our thinking at times.
I think this is very good. And that's why I think the requirement could read, start by saying, in case a company, an entity, commonly uses supplementary measures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That would already clarify a lot. Then it has to enter, identify which one they are and put it in the notes. Jianqiao?
Thank you, Hans. Generally, I agree with the proposal the staff made. I also, the point I like made exactly the same as previous many of you mentioned, that try, the wording is very important. We try, don't give the impression to the stakeholder, to the preparers, that those management performance measures that and also those subtotals and totals required by the standard are competing with each other. They are actually supplementing each other. So those management performance measures should play a role, supplemental role, to the subtotals and the totals required by our standard. I think this is very important because we're using those, we are required, prepared to identify which is the best one, you know, best measure to communicate to the user, something like that. So with regard to wording, I have a suggestion. Try to simplify the paragraph 3A, including 3A and 3A. Just to say that if an entity discloses a measure or measures of financial performance and it is not a subtotal or total required by the paragraph 81A or IS1, then the measure is a management performance measure. Then go on. The requirement in paragraph 3A apply, just simply. Yeah. If the entity disclose those measures, but those measures are not the subtotals or totals required by the 81A of ISA, then those requirements of paragraph 3AB applies. I think it's quite simple. And we can avoid all those wording misunderstanding and try to define those wording, something like that. I think this is my suggestion, try to avoid some misunderstanding of the wording. Actually, we agree with the direction, yeah, but the wording need to be clarified further.
Sue?
So I think Tom's question was a good one, and I would have answered complimentary, but I would have then given a different explanation from, I think, where Tom explained it, so maybe it depends what you think complimentary and supplementary mean. But I thought one of the things that... So, my starting understanding was that we weren't really proposing to do anything that would tinker with what would be already required under paragraph 85. Mm-hmm. So if you thought something was a relevant measure in accordance with 85, that's on the face, that's already required, and we're not changing that. But then in addition, we were coming along and saying, by the way, if you've got these management performance metrics, we want to have one note that's got them all in one place. So that would potentially include some stuff that might already be on the face. Yeah. And it may even be just our net profit after tax IFRS number. Could be other stuff which is already on the face because of paragraph 85, and then it could be additional stuff as well. But one thing was to try and get it all in one place. Is that true?
Yes.
But I did have one question about the interaction between that, even that understanding, and paragraph 85 that I just wanted to check with you. So at the moment,
paragraph 85 says that if something's relevant to an understanding or some words like that, then it should be on the face, and obviously that can only happen if it fits the structure and they meet all the reconciliation requirements and all of that stuff. But the sort of starting presumption is that if it's relevant, it should be there, and we know based on some limited conversations we've had so far, people in different countries are doing different things, which I think maybe we should look at further during our comment period. But we do know as a sort of general proposition that was the basic idea. And I see that in the words that we've got in question one of the sort of requirements around the measure that's proposed by the staff is the fact that the measure must be relevant to an understanding of the entity's financial performance. Does that create some sort of link between paragraph 85 and these notes and somehow potentially sort of elevate more stuff that maybe they wouldn't have already concluded they should disclose under 85? So should we have the relevant word in here?
Well, I don't think it would. The intention is that it wouldn't, just that because of our proposed structure that less measures would be fit on the face, so those measures may meet the paragraph 85 but wouldn't meet the proposed structures, and those would be the measures that would be in this note disclosure.
I suppose Sue's question is, do we need the word relevant? We're getting a lot of people agreeing around what you've got here, want some drafting changes, but agreement. How essential is the word relevant, do you think, in 1-1? It's on line 2 of 1-1 of question 1. Do we need the word relevant, or can we do it without that word?
Well, initially we had it without. We had no constraints whatsoever. And we have actually added that requirement after considering what we were proposing in the discussion paper, the principle of disclosure, that you have to explain if you're putting these performance measures in the financial statements, you need to explain why they're relevant to an understanding. And so that's where the thinking has come from, but before, in the previous proposals, it was that there were no constraints, so it may be something that's worth getting.
And was I correct in my understanding that one of the intentions was, or the sort of vision, if you like, of the way that this is drafted, is that we could potentially have some replication between what would be on the face and what would be in this note?
Yes. Yes.
Françoise?
Well, I mean, like many of us, I mean, I'm happy with the analysis that has been conducted in this paper and how the comments that were offered last time were dealt with. I support the bulk of the recommendation, but having heard the discussion, I have the possibility of reacting to a number of things. So first of all, to say that I support that we review the drafting of 1.1 so that it's indeed the supplementary thing and not necessary there. Whether we put the constraint on the management performance measure of having to be relevant to understanding of financial performance or not, I think the paragraph 85A will act as a filter. So if it's not there, we still have the outcome that we wish, so I don't think it's necessary. Maybe it would avoid useless discussions in practice. So I could go with or without. Then I have a point that was not mentioned so far, and it relates to the recommendation in 1.3 little b. I would wish that the measure is labeled and that we have the same constraint as we have today in 85A. That is, that it is in a manner that makes the line items that constitute the subtotal clear and understandable. Because, you know, when referring to this paragraph 15 that you referred us to, when we say, well, they label it the way they wish, I don't have an issue with profit before taxation because that's descriptive of IFRS elements. I don't have any problem with profit from continuing operation for the same reason. I have an issue with gross profit, because gross profit is not necessarily being described, and that could be misleading. So I wouldn't want to have the same constraint as we have already in the paragraph.
Tak.
Thank you. Before voting, I would like to make clear what we are voting for. So bear with me a second. We have three types of subtotals in the profit and loss statement and notes. One is a subtotal mentioned in paragraph 81, which is the six subtotals shown in the paragraph 14 in this paper. And secondly, we still have a paragraph 85. So that's a kind of supplementary paragraph, which is relevant to the performance. So then here comes, we have MPM. So some subtotal of MPM could be overlapped with the subtotal as a paragraph 85, but some are not. So on the face of the statement of financial performance, there is some subtotal which is just for paragraph 85, but not MPM. But there is some subtotal which is paragraph 85 and MPM. So here comes the question about the labeling issue, which Francois pointed out, question 1.3b. So you have to put the good label. But do you not require to make clear that this is MPM, rather than to distinguish from the other subtotal, which is just complying paragraph 85? Do you not require? Because if it is not required, in the first place, when you read the financial statements, there are two line items. Unless you read the notes of reconciliation, you wouldn't know which is MPM, which is not. Is that what you are proposing?
I'm the proposals that, yes, you wouldn't know from looking at the face unless it was described in a different way that it was going to be a management performance measure identified in the notes.
So until you read the notes, you wouldn't know which is MPM. Mm-hmm. But we could simply avoid, just simply say, put some, it's a MPM with a bracket or something. If we require that, then a reader can spot which is the MPM very easily. Yeah. Please think about it. Thank
you. Gary?
Yeah. A minor point from earlier discussion and this reaction to what Tak said. I think I'm on page 16, paragraph 1.1 of recommendations. The discussion was relevant. Do we should that word or not? Yeah. What would strike me is the second part of that, if in management's view of management best communicates to users, I think those words by itself make it relevant. I mean, am I missing something in there? Or is, I would say it's redundant, relevant in management's view of the best communication. They're saying it's relevant because it best communicates. So I don't know if that's a big deal or not, but just a reaction. And thought crossed my mind when Taka was speaking is I think if we go this route, I think management is going to try very hard to get this on the face of the P&L. One, because you open the door to do so, but if it is that important, doesn't seem like it should only be in the footnotes. That's why I think the forces of nature will try to drive it to be on the face of the P&L. Now, that will not always be able to be the case. But I think people will try hard to make it happen. Is you think of an earnings release, you know, maybe by law you have to lead with the, you know, the GAAP or the IFRS number, but the next number immediately is the number you want people to focus on, be it income, earnings per share, or whatever, and you tend to have the whole earnings release, the first page would focus on that. So I think logic would be to hold consistency in communication, sort of equal prominence in related communications. I think people are going to try very hard to get on the face of the P&L if it otherwise can be made to fit. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with it only being in the footnotes, but I think it detracts from how important is it if it's not somehow directly on the face of the P&L.
Nick?
Just to pick up a couple of things. Just firstly, again, I think users will be happy wherever it is, but except preparers may want to put it onto the P&L. I think we'll struggle with a number of things because, you know, it just won't work. So I think it will be reasonably balanced. I'm not sure that we need to flag this on the face of the P&L that some things in NPM. I think that leads to prominence again, and I'm quite happy where we are, where we've landed already on that. But I wouldn't be adverse to, as outlined in paragraph 15, considering some additional defined subtotals. I think profit before tax would be one, profit from continuing operations, even EBITDA. I would have be very reluctant to have gross profit as one of the reasons that we've outlined before. I don't think it's such a poor measure as it stands today in terms of the allocations. It doesn't work very well, but I would be open to others, certainly.
Would you prohibit gross profit? That is a widely used number.
It's a number I never use because I felt there's a lack of comparability there. But, I mean, I think prohibiting it would take us down a whole new avenue of debate, which is probably a fight that we don't need to have.
Yeah. No, it's not all industries, but
yeah.
Commercial industrial companies.
Indeed.
It is
yeah.
Very common.
And many analysts do like it as well, I'd say.
You're not one of them.
No.
What's that?
I was reacting in a manner similar to Nick. I think we have the strength of the disaggregation requirement in IS1, and as much as this is complied with, the better. And not having to mention any reference to management performance measures, I think was a good response to the comments made by the board generally last time. So I'm very comfortable with that. And also having taken the CMAQ input into that discussion, where it was clear that they were not asking, they didn't see any superiority in having it in the income statement or not.
Gary?
And just quickly, back on paragraph 15, putting aside gross profit, I would strongly endorse putting profit before tax and profit from continuing operations. Put them in, I guess, paragraph 81, is regard they are so commonly used. And by the way, they might very well be the management performance measure would resolve a lot of the issues we're talking about here.
Is the staff planning to come back with us?
Could come back with a proposal. We could do.
Okay. Now, Tom?
Cool.
I wanted to just pick up tax thing as well, because just on the 85 is I do have a concern that, so in paragraph 19, we say we can abandon this in part because we're relying on 85. Then paragraph 22 comes back and reinforces 85. And that sort of goes all the way through this. The one concern I have is when I look at these, when they appear in management commentaries, they typically use the word relevant or an equivalent. And so my big question is, how are people reading 85 today? Do we have a huge problem there? Because it seems to me that some of these should be creeping in to the primary financial statements under 85, at least more than are currently creeping in. And so if we're going to rely on 85... but it's not working the way we think. I think we need to understand that dynamic really well. So I just have this reservation. There's this bit of a gap between what we observe and what we think the standard says.
Responding to Tom then, I think some information is about how the regulators control, either audit firms control format via templates, or regulators do via their guidance. So that's part of when you say we need to understand how 85 and 85A works, we know there's another party that's influencing how 85 and 85A are used. As we proceed with this project, I would expect auditors and regulators to look at our materials, and potentially some of them will change their position, I would expect.
I could just follow up. I agree. And it's that we may have some idea. I don't think we have enough of an idea. And if it is the auditors and regulators, and I think paragraph 6B actually introduces
this is a kind of a rationale for doing it right at the bottom. It said some preparers told us they wanted to present their view of financial performance in their financial statements, but without guidance in IFRS standards, they're reluctant to do so because regulators, auditors may question and challenge. So we've identified that at least as one of the things. We don't actually know what the regulators and auditors would, you know, if we go through this. So I'm still back with wanting to understand this dynamic really well, especially if what we end up doing relies heavily on 85. Then 85 has to be there functioning.
Sue?
I think what's quite good about the approach the staff has taken is that it sort of works irrespective of how people are reading 85. You may get more or less overlap depending on how people are reading the words, but we're not sort of wading into interpretation of 85 per se. But I think what I think we should do is when we're out getting comments on whatever it is we put out for comment, we should at the same time take the opportunity to understand better what is going out there with 85 in terms of application. I think there's some differences in understanding of what even our objectives were when we did the consequential amendments to put in 85A and, you know, how significant or not they were supposed to be and what the sort of outcome was we were anticipating. So I think it would be good to do some extra work, but I think we can do that sort of in parallel. And I think it is important because this project is all about, is there enough, you know, on the face in large part for people to understand performance, and 85 to me already requires some of that. But I think I wouldn't hold up for that. I'd do it in parallel, but I think we should do it.
Okay. I think we're ready to vote. Then I see who supports the staff's recommendation as formulated in question one.
Subject to the wordings we've discussed.
Well, of course.
14.
Yeah, but the wording, I was going to say, we have discussed this three times, and first of all, it's more complicated than it seems at first sight, and the scope for misunderstandings is huge, so the precise wording of the proposals will be very important, but I think the staff realizes that. Okay.
The second part of the paper is about the location of the management performance measure reconciliation. The staff are recommending that the management performance measure reconciliation is disclosed in the notes, and this was also the board's tentative decision at its January meeting. Now, at the recent CMAP meeting, some CMAP members gave us feedback that it would be easier for them to locate the reconciliation if it was provided below the statement of financial performance rather than in the notes. Now, in light of this feedback and the further development of our proposals, does the board want to revisit our decision to require the management performance measure reconciliation to be disclosed in the notes?
No. Nope. Nick?
Thank you. One of the pieces of consistent feedback from users is they'd like to find this a consistent place in the financial reports rather than have to search through this. Having said that, I do accept our previous discussion. If we're doing a reconciliation of the MPM and then a reconciliation to the adjusted EPS, this would be a lot of information to potentially accommodate within the primary financial statements. And so the only compromise I can think of is that we have it in a consistent note location. Note 2 is your MPM adjusted EPS reconciliation.
Thank you. I'm still wondering about the equal prominence. So as I clarified, there are two types of total, which is MPM, which is not MPM. And also, there are two types of MPM, which is on the face, which is only on the notes. So sometimes MPM on the notes is the most important information. But that users who only read face cannot know what is the most important information. So that is one of the most dangerous points of our proposal. So that's why I said, why don't we abolish paragraph 85? But it's not possible. So if it is not possible, only the way to keep the equal prominence is to put this reconciliation adjacent to profit and loss statement. Of course, just a note number two in the same location may work, but in practice, actually, there are many practices. Make a press release, only statements of performance reporting, financial performance, and then notes a few days later. So there is lots of such kind of practices. In that case, most important information is missing in the timing of press release or a flash report. So therefore, in order to attach such a most important information with the financial statement, I think we should put it in somewhere adjacent to profit and loss statement, and it should be released at the same time.
Mary?
I'm afraid I'm going to take almost directly opposite view to talk here. One is, I think we're trying to do something that we have to remember is going to be used in many different countries and make it many different regulatory regimes. And I think it's important that we're showing leadership in strengthening the usefulness of IFRS financial statements consistently across marketplaces. But every one more thing we add increases the risk of conflict with regulatory regimes and knock-on effects. And I think we just have to think about that in kind of a cost-benefit type way. Now, I think many, we've mentioned in passing different approaches regulators have taken to management performance measures, influencing what's been shown today. I, strongly feel that we should not reconsider our previous discussion about permission to present the items on the face. I think it is, overall a balanced response to the desire of users to be able to find it in a consistent place to say, if it's not one of the paragraph 81 items, then you must reconcile it and that reconciliation must be on the note. I think requiring it or permitting it to be on the face, permitting it would split where you're going to find it, and requiring it to be on the face, there's issues of room as long as you're constrained by a sheet of paper. There's issues of greater risk of conflict with regulatory requirements. There's concern regarding elevation. But all of this, and Nick, you say we have to put it in note two. I don't think we ever specify what has to be. Practices evolve that accounting policies are very often note one, but we don't require that. And
let's say it's a note one then. Fine. Ideal. Even better. Thank you.
I don't think we should be specifying that, especially, I want a gold star for this, for saying as we think about the electronic reporting world, if we have a specific tag for the, this required disclosure, somebody who's using any form of search should be able to find it by specifying that tag. But I can see that we should ask in the invitation to comment. The feedback we've heard is people want to be able to know whether there is a management performance measure and how it relates to the P&L and to be able to find it in a consistent place. Here's what we've said. Is this sufficiently responsive? Any concerns about regulatory
regime? Rachel promises to make a specific day.
You have to hold me to that.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the answer is no.
13.
Sorry, what was the question we asked?
We're not going to read
question two.
You kind of asked it. You asked it the reverse of what it's written.
The staff.
You agree not to reconsider.
I agree
with staff in question two.
Well, it's not really a question.
That's not a question two.
Staff has no opinion.
Do you agree that we should not revisit our tentative decision to require the reconciliation in the notes?
Yeah.
Rather than on the first.
So do we not want to change our previous decision?
I agree with that.
Okay.
John Wu, you...
Yes.
Well, it's...
We did.
Let's say we were just waiting his vote.
I think it was only two not.
That's unanimous.
Tech and unanimous. No, it was a yes in the end, because I don't want it on the face.
No. Unanimous.
No.
I voted against it, sorry.
13.
Dr. Loves are lost cops. All right.
on to paper 21B. This is actually the third time we're bringing an agenda paper on the just the DPS to the board. However, we haven't yet discussed the proposal because they depended on where we got to with the management performance measure. Because of the development of our proposals for management performance measures, the specific details of the proposals in this paper are different than in previous EPS papers. However, the overall proposal has stayed the same, which is the staff are proposing that if an entity has identified a management performance measure, it should be required to provide an adjusted EPS calculated consistently with that management performance measure. Now, the paper discusses what we mean by calculated consistently. However, before getting into the detail of that, I think it might be best to approach this paper by asking for comments on the first part of question one. It's so asking broadly whether board members are supportive of a proposal whereby if an entity identifies a management performance measure under the proposals in paper 21A, it must disclose an adjusted EPS calculated consistently with the management performance measure.
Martin has managed to keep quiet in the previous discussion, but now he's saying redoubled force.
And I don't agree with the staff recommendation. The reason is very simple. The reason is very simple because
he wouldn't disappoint me. Okay, sorry, Martin.
No problem. And I think you all know that I'm not so happy that we're proposing all that. But now we're proposing even a step further, because even if a company has only a pre-tax management performance measure and maybe had good reasons only have a pre-tax because they cannot allocate the tax amount based for this adjustment, but then now we're forcing them also to have that through the bottom line and calculate an EPS, even if the company is not using this kind of management performance measure. And I don't understand really why. Why we are doing that? And secondly, it's okay because I think also it is very, very complicated for many companies, because also the reason for many companies to using only a pre-tax number is because they cannot allocate the tax number based on a restructuring which is over legal entities or whatever or any other adjustment. And now we are forcing them to doing that because I think only some users want them to calculate the bottom line impact. But why not having this tax impact on any kind of separate line item? And I really think the cost benefit is not okay. And what main concern is really why we are requiring that, okay, now management performance after tax EPS number to bring into the financial statements, even if the company is not doing that. So I understand maybe that we have what we discussed earlier today is, okay, if management think it is a kind of good, relevant information, then maybe we're doing that. I finally agreed to that. But now we're proposing that even management does not using it at all, but we're requiring that. Why, what is the rationale for that? Only that people can calculate the tax and MZI number on that, why not for any other things? Because I think users can make adjustments for all kind of things, not only for things, okay, the management has identified that. So I think it goes too far. That is really my concern.
Nick?
Thank you. I think it fits into the complementary camp again. I think it's very frustrating where you have an operating measure which makes some adjustments, and then that hangs there in isolation. You can't feed it through to EPS. EPS is one of those measures that's used commonly across the market. I've experienced this on a number of occasions, and it's impossible as a user in isolation to make those adjustments. And I think that's separate from the tax and NCI consequences. Where those particularly come into play is where there are a number of adjustments, and a user wants to say, actually, I accept the restructuring as a one-off expense, but I don't accept the adjustment for the share-based payment. So actually, I'm not going to give them the benefit of the doubt that, but in that case, I need to know the tax consequences and the NCI consequences around that. Now, a number of preparers already give that information on that basis, and indeed from GPF we heard from preparers, at least one preparer, that they do that today and it wasn't too hard to do today, is what they told us. I think it's particularly important to have this data as a buy-side user. So as a sell-side user, you'll often follow the consensus, the adjusted EPS as set by management. You want to be able to measure your own performance in terms of where your EPS number falls against the consensus. So you're very much guided by the management-defined EPS number. As a buy-side user, you want to have the discretion, as I mentioned earlier, to actually say, no, I don't accept that adjustment. I think that is a part of a cost of running the business. So I want.
But if the company does not make a kind, for example, if not adjusting for restructuring, you also don't have this information. But if you, as an analyst, want to make, for example, an adjustment for restructuring expense, but the company does not, you don't have the tax impact. Only if the company is doing that, then you think, okay, you need the tax impact.
So
that is not logical for me.
It may not be logical, but the behavior in practice. The behavior and practice is that most of the times where there are restructuring expenses, they are looking to have those, as, by and large, those are then treated as an adjustment. It's very rare indeed for it to operate the other way around. So in terms of the balance of where the information is, it still works in favor of having this number. It's very frustrating not to be able to follow an adjusted operating number through to an EPS number.
If you have an performance measure with is currency stable revenues, can you imagine how to make a tax impact out of that? I could not how to do that in practice.
I wouldn't have a currency stable measure as an MPM.
But some companies who have that. And we're requiring that thing down to the EPS. That is a proposal here. It's too hard.
And that's one reason why I've consistently said I wouldn't have a current constant currency
next time I'm
number.
You guys together. Over now?
Yes. Outside.
You may have to start smoking.
Okay, now we're running. Calmer voice, Tom.
I have another. I'm just going to stick with following up on Martin's comment. And I have a question related to it. In IAS 33, paragraph 73, we have a rule on what happens today. And I think the only constraint is if you're going to do an earnings per share, you have to use the weighted average number of ordinary shares determined in accordance with standard, basic and diluted ones, whichever. And then they say an entity shall indicate the basis and so on, whether the amounts are per share are before or after tax. So my question is, when they wrote that standard, they sounded sympathetic to me when the outcome to what Martin was saying about cost and complexity. It left a lot of discretion in the hands of the entity. And if somebody could enlighten me, is the fact that that standard reads the way it does confirm what Martin's saying about cost and complexity?
Going back in a time machine.
I think the answer is that certainly as a staff we don't know, and I'm not even sure that there's a basis for conclusion for us to actually reach that.
Because that's one of the original paragraphs.
So they don't know.
Right. So, and one thing is, I am sympathetic that these things. So if we're observing that a lot of them are currently choosing not to take things down to the earnings per share level, and I'm sympathetic to what Nick said, that a lot of users really like to have that earnings per share number. But I think Martin makes also a valid point that if a lot of them are currently choosing not to take it down to earnings per share, if we have a standard that sort of gave people freedom not to take it down to earnings per share, and I'm assuming we did due diligence at the time, that I think there's a lot of evidence that entities see a very poor cost-benefit trade-off to taking it all the way to earnings per share. And in some sense, I think the onus would be on us to demonstrate that taking it to earnings per share would be a significantly large benefit to overcome what appear to me to be demonstrable costs just based on the other evidence.
Darrell?
I think the space I'm in is the same one as Nick explained, and I think it came out quite well, I thought, in the two different opinions that we heard in the GPF. And in some ways it captures a lot of the discussion that happened between Nick and Martin, I think. the entities that supported the idea of taking it all the way down to EPS were because they were thinking about this as a genuine alternative way of viewing their company. And they felt that it was necessary if you were thinking about future cash flows for the company, if you're thinking about future growth prospects and the like, that you needed to think about it at each level of the measurement space. Some of the other entities that talked about the idea of how hard it would be to take it down were very often looking at this as almost an internal budgeting type metrics. So the common currency type measures and et cetera, they weren't thinking about it as a whole of entity performance measure. So I think in some ways, by requiring it to go all the way down to EPS, I think we actually impose an additional element of discipline on how you think about the MPM in the first place. And I would agree with those who said that I need to understand how this particular thing, if I'm removing restructuring costs, I need to understand how those restructuring costs have affected all elements of the calculation all the way down. If management's telling me I need to think about the business without those restructuring costs, I want to be able to think about the whole business. So I think both because it's a more sensible outcome and because it potentially imposes a little bit more discipline on the process, that it's a necessary way of doing it. And then I agree with Martin, this is going to be sometimes very difficult to do. But I think that very difficult to do thing is about saying, what we'd be saying here is that management still has a better perspective on the tax consequences and other things than what an outsider does having a look at that. And again, we need to come back to the point that management is asking outsiders to understand that this is their way of looking at business. I think they need to then provide the information that supports that.
Mary?
I'm succumbing a bit to, on the one hand, on the other hand, kind of thinking about this. And ultimately I come down to saying, I think we absolutely need to consult about this point. On the one hand, the Nick hand, the paper captures a number of very persuasive and important arguments about how especially sophisticated users of financial statements use some of the information, especially management adjustments, and how the population of data that they have to work with currently is incomplete because of the missing NCI and tax figures. On the other hand, I can think of scenarios, and the constant currency is one, and there's some others, that I think we may be underestimating the challenges to operationalizing this. And that brings me to saying, I really want to consult explicitly about this. And I think the only way we're going to really get feedback about it is not just asking a question, but having a proposal that says this is what it would mean if we carried it forward. And it's, you know, I say include it as a proposal, not just to be mean and to get people's attention, but in part informed by the fact that our preliminary soundings to date, and that's the category I put the discussion with the GPF in, had a number of people expressing the feasibility and, you know, current practice of doing it. But I think we should flag it as something that we feel we don't have a good handle given the potential range of items, you know, about carrying it all the way through and get input on that. So the kind of lukewarm support, but cautious support, because I can, on the Martin hand, see, you know, as I say, a number, depending upon what your adjustment is, how regularly you make it, and whether you're just trying to isolate something that in this period you think is abnormal or the effects of a particular item, as opposed to I have this consistent way of measuring performance from a management perspective. And those are kind of two different takes at how you're doing your analysis.
Gary?
Thank you. And I have sort of mixed feelings, you know, across the board on this, but if you're looking at paper 21A and paragraph 21, your illustrative disclosure of NPMs and adjusted EPS, I mean, former life did stuff like this all the time, you know, not with 5 or 6 subtotals like we got there, but in terms of EPS affecting transactions or items that you wanted flagged out, either it's a one-off or just like adding back amortization. So I think it can be done. You know, however, I wouldn't support doing it at the moment without further development of how you would do it. Again, if noting in paper 21B, makes clear up in paragraph 2 or 3, you're not considering the denominator, not considering other things, I think I'd like to understand, well, are we going to consider it before this goes out? I mean, if you're just kind of going through, these are issues I dealt with, but I think they're common. Well, how would you tax affect individual adjustments using, and I think we have to give guidance on it. Is it, do you use it the group effective tax rate? Is it the statutory rate? Is it the with and without rate? And so on, for how you would tax affect it. What do you do if you've got one of your management adjustments that turns a consolidated loss, now it's into a profit, and your number of dilutive and antidilutive shares change? It could go on, or sudden you have contingently issuable or vestable shares only if you make money. You lost money, they didn't vest, and they add them back. Well, do you pretend they did vest? The list goes on, you know, at length. And if one of our goals in the conceptual framework is comparability, these questions have to be answered. Now, you might say we could conclude, I suppose, these are a policy election, just disclosure policy, but that is an answer. But one thing I'll guarantee, where there's no consistency in the world on there, is these one-off pro forma adjustment calculations. So I think, and to support it, I think I would want you to have to bring all these things back. If not, I'd be inclined to say, don't do it.
Well, I think I'm more or less where Mary is on this issue, so I'm not going to repeat what she said. In addition, I was surprised that we would require an EPS for each management performance measure provided. So to me, I mean, one would expect that one is already satisfying the user, and I would have selected the one that was the most inclusive, representing that management performance measure, which is the most inclusive and not required for all of them.
Sue?
I can see both sides of the argument as well, but I think it's something worth asking a question on, and trying to be perhaps quite balanced in the way it's presented in terms of the different considerations. But I was going to peek ahead a little bit, like Francoise just did, because much more sanguine about having an additional adjusted EPS for a senior management, but our wording clearly envisages that there could be multiple. We could get an awful lot of extra information then, and maybe then it's relevant and it's useful. But I think that's something that takes it to a different level.
Are we discussing question two as well?
Well, I'm peeking ahead because I think it's sort of
declared she was peeking ahead, even though she was wrong to do it.
I was misbehaving. I acknowledge I was misbehaving.
Nick?
So now we have a mandate to peek ahead. I think multiple adjusted EPS numbers would also be unwelcome and confusing. I think if you're having consistent adjustments through the P&L, you should end up with the same number. I think the more defined subtotals we have, there's less opportunity there is to end up with multiple adjusted EPS numbers as well, just the way the maths works. And so I'd hope, through consistency, perhaps through adding some more of those subtotals that we talked about earlier, profit before tax, profit for continuing, perhaps EBITDA, you would, by and large, end up with one adjusted EPS number. And I think that's where preparers would want to end up as well. I don't think preparers would really want to end up in those circumstances where there's more than one. It wouldn't be in their interest either.
Martin.
And I only want one thing to add, because if a company is following pure IFRS, doesn't adjust for restructuring, doesn't adjust for impairment, doesn't adjust for one-off gains, and an investor maybe want to adjust for all that. In this situation, the investor doesn't have that information because the company is following pure IFRS.
It's the best, isn't it?
No, you don't have that information because maybe in your model you want to adjust for restructuring, you want to adjust for one-off impairment, you want to adjust for one-off gains. But if a company following pure IFRS, you don't get that information. If a company is then adjusting for all these kind of things, then during this proposal, an investor get all this kind of information. I think that is not logic for me. Mm. And if I think we think, okay, there are certain items investors usually adjust for in their models, restructuring, impairment charges, whatever, then we should say, okay, in the disclosure, please, if you have this kind of charges, please provide the tax number allocated to that for all kind of information. But I don't like we link it now to all this kind of management performance measures. And that is, for me, not logical. Because then a user of a company which follows our pure IFRS requirements don't have that information. Mm-hmm. The company which plays around with MPM's non-GAAP numbers get all this information. And for me, that is not good reporting, sorry to say that. And if we really have a kind of thing, maybe I convince you, if you want, as an investor, want to have a kind of modeling this, you need a tax number. I totally agree. But maybe you're doing it with an estimate, but then I think we should say, okay, the 90% of companies using restructuring this kind of things, and then, okay, so you have to provide, even if you don't use it as a management performance measure, as a tax number allocated to that. I maybe could agree to that more than if you link it to the management performance measure.
Anne?
When we look at question one, it seems obvious, to me anyway, it seems obvious that if there's an adjusted EPS, it should be calculated on the same basis as the management performance measure. Standing back and looking at it, it seems obvious. You found that sometimes that's not the case. What I've observed in practice is that there are many companies that do a management performance measure and they don't take it down to EPS. So I think that supports Mary and others who've said we're really not sure whether we should be mandating that you need to produce an EPS, adjusted EPS, when you do identify an MPM. Because what we can observe in practice, even though under 33 they can do it and disclose it and put it in the notes, many do not. So I think that tells us something. The other thing I observe is that there is one adjusted EPS number. There isn't any adjusted EPS for all the different management performance measures that are provided. So a company may discuss two or three management performance measures, but they will get to one adjusted EPS. Because even if they have one adjusted EPS, they can convert that into many. They multiply because you've got basic and diluted, continuing and discontinued, adjusted basic, adjusted, diluted, discontinued, and continuing. So already on the face, somebody might sit those, however many that were. So, but what I do observe is there's generally one EPS, adjusted EPS, and it's a bottom number. It's not a high number. It's a low number. Good. Thank you.
Doug.
Thank you. Can I talk about the question two, or shall I wait?
Yeah, we are peeking ahead.
Okay, thank you. I agree with the staff proposal on the question one, but strongly disagree with question two. The reason is provided by Gary. I think if you have hundreds of subsidiaries, then it is really burdensome for the preparers, and it is quite hard, and it takes long time to prepare this number. So therefore, it delays to disclose some of the notes. And also, it could discourage preparers to disclose MPM because it is linked to MPM. Once you decide MPM, you have to disclose this. Then you have to do all this work, especially when MPM is a high-level number like a gross profit or a business profit. Then you have to go through lots of numbers, lots of rows in this table. So it's quite hard to do that. Especially the company has a lots of subsidiary overseas. So segregating currency effect is really difficult. Having said that, I do understand the user need some reconciliation to MPM to the level of EPS. So therefore, the compromise I can make is to agree with question one, but not question two.
I do not want to peek ahead.
I'm going to just take us back once more, just tidying up something. This is sort of a bit of a tangent, but it's a point I made before. We've agreed to, well, actually, let me define something first. My supervisor years ago did a paper on debt covenants, and it contrasted debt covenants written in the gap of the day or the location with tailor-made accounting principles, and he called them TAP, so I'm going to use TAP in his honor. We have proposed that we have both exclusions and TAP. And the point I made previously is, if you read our documents, we use the verb exclude. We don't mention TAP. All our examples are exclusions, no TAPs. So first I have that concern that you want to raise. And then I have a direct question. I think a lot of the things we talked about the complexity of tax, there we're talking with exclusions. You've probably identified the item being excluded, and the entity probably has some idea about how that expense, whether it traces into tax, and the timing of it. If they, however, substitute their own insurance revenue rate standard or they do an accelerated revenue standard, we're going to have timing differences between the TAP and IFRS, and then timing differences between IFRS. So my question is, have we thought about this added level of complexity if we're going to require EPS for all, both TAPs and exclusions?
We haven't got worked through the detail of how much guidance we're providing. What do you mean by TAPs?
What I just described, the accelerate revenue.
Mm-hmm. But we haven't got to that level of detail.
So is your point, Tom, that the tax effects would be difficult to calculate because of the different timings of the revenues that are coming through? Is that...
Well, I think it's an added layer of complexity, just as I described. I think if you're doing an exclusion, you at least have some stuff in the books that you can trace and so on, because it's essentially going through the same accounting process. And if I decide to create my own revenue, right, I'm going to accelerate it. So it's like you'd probably have to create a pseudo-deferred tax account for the difference between my TAP and IFRS, and then you've got the deferred tax account between IFRS and the taxable thing. And just coming back to Martin's point is, I would like us, since we at the present are contemplating both exclusions and TAP, that as we roll through these things, that we pick up the TAPs.
By TAP, you mean a tailored accounting?
Tailor-made accounting principles.
Tailor-made accounting principles.
So I mean, the short answer is that no, we haven't gone into that level of detail of thinking about, you know, how would you go about calculating the tax effects when you had something like an acceleration of revenue. And I suppose a question for the board would be whether we actually wanted to get into that level of detail, or whether we wanted to say something like, come up with a reasonable basis for calculating your tax and describe what that basis is.
Part of this is to realise that tax is definitely one of the issues, but in fact your balance sheet is one of the issues. If you've got an accelerated revenue recognition, you're actually going to have different debtors, potentially different creditors, different all sorts of things. Yep. And I think one of the difficulties we've had with these alternative measures is that there's no need to balance the balance sheet. But I think tax is one issue, but I think it's actually broader than just tax.
No, I would agree. And that's my generic starting point is that we need to... Well, all our examples have been exclusions, which I think are one level less complex. Then we go to a TAP for all those reasons. And even the TAPs, I'm sort of trying to do some mind games about what kinds might be created. I think they would differ in their complexity. So suppose somebody decided to do for stock-based compensation just the difference when you actually cash them. You know, that would be a possibility. Somebody might do it. When we created that standard, some people advocated that. Another one that's out there is there's a pile of people advocating for capitalizing more internal intangibles. So suppose somebody decided to do that. And I just think that the more complexity we add, as Martin points out, even with the exclusions, will be that much more complex for the range of TAPs that may get created. So I just think we should, as we go through creating things, as long as we're planning to do both exclusions and TAPs, I think we need to keep in mind how it would work for a TAP, tailor-made accounting principle.
Amaru?
Thanks, Sus.
I must say that without getting to the next questions, I'm very sympathetic to Martin's reaction. I think we started the project, at least in my mind, with a very simple objective of trying to explain a little bit more what is the management performance, what are the management performance measures, and giving the proper information to users. And now we are getting more and more complexity under the whole project, and I'm getting really, really nervous. I don't want to mention the next questions, but to me, I must vote no to question one, because question two, three, four, and five just make it worse to me in terms of complexity, and far, far away from what was in my mind the objective of the project at inception. I think we are really overcomplicating things, and without a clear view about the outcome.
Unless we would see this as a deterrent to use MPMs, and then Martin would get his way.
Yeah, at the end of the day. Yeah. The end of the day, the message could be viewed as, well, the ISB don't want us really to use MPMs anymore.
Yet, I'm trying to sort of strike a middle ground. I don't know if I'll succeed, but we could, I suppose, consider permit but not require is an alt way to go forward. I still think we'd have to answer a lot of the questions about how you would do it. I'm sympathetic to those companies that don't, in fact, do these adjustments, making them do it, when heretofore and they have not had the need to or the market demand to do and so on. On the other hand, those that do it, they've got a little bit less sympathy for it. Now, maybe it's permit or not, or require only if used, say, in another part of the annual reporting package or in your earnings release, you commonly use them. I can actually buy Nick's arguments, I can also buy, or the reasoning behind them, and can buy that if it's in the footnotes, there'll be an audit discipline, there'll be a little bit greater discipline around them than keeping them outside it, I suppose. At least that's, perhaps sometimes a benefit. But if you're not doing them today, I really are bothered about pseudo tax affecting pre-tax amounts, that are a subset of a reporting entity or a subset of a group, because there's a lot of ways to do it. So I don't know what the permit but not require is, I guess, is simply the proposal. The other thing is, Michelle, are you thinking doing this on basic EPS or diluted EPS or both?
Both.
Both, okay.
Nick?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we do live in a complex world, and users have to grapple with this complexity. And often, some of the information which they're asking to help with that complexity is information that they can't estimate. To understand whether restructuring is in particular tax jurisdiction, differential tax rates, whether some items are tax deductible or not tax deductible, that information they have very little insight on today. It's impossible to estimate as an outsider. I do worry, just in response to tax comment about taking business profits through to an MPM, I wonder if staff could clarify this, because...
Business profits, sorry.
Example
should be gross profit.
Okay, so business profit, just to clarify, if you were to take business profit through to an adjusted EPS, you'd get the same number as an IFRS EPS, so there would be no difference. The only adjustment would be if you took business profit excluding restructuring, then you get a different adjusted EPS. So I just wanted to clarify that was the case, and there wasn't another layer of complications we were talking about.
I'm wondering if there's another way to approach this, given some people's misgivings on what the proposals are, and that would be by saying, if you provide an adjusted EPS, then reconcile the earnings number numerator back to your MPM.
That's not responsive to Nick's original argument, though, about the... It would be pulling back on satisfying that user information.
It would... That would appear in the note, in this one note. It would be in there, so it's in one place. Mm-hmm. People can find it. It would deal with the potential confusion about the MPM and the adjusted earnings in the EPS. are not the same. We're asking for a reconciliation there. There are some elements of what Nick would like to see. It doesn't address that, but it does provide some information without going as far into the area that's in the paper that's causing a lot of people concern.
Right, but the problem, I mean, subject to Amaro's caution about spiraling out of control beyond the very basic original objective, the second or third objective that we're trying to satisfy in this paper is users want to be able to go through adjustments that management make and kind of accept or reject them. And if they reject them, to understand what the full through to the bottom line effect is. And so whether or not management presents an EPS number, the user wants that information about NCI and tax for that accept, reject kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's right and we must satisfy it, but that your proposal satisfies a quite different set of information requests.
But Nick's information could be required as part of a reconciliation.
Well, that's what we're suggesting. That's what we're suggesting.
Not an EPS reconciliation, but a reconciliation between IFRS and MPMs.
It's essentially a reconciliation of the numerator anyway, isn't it? Because you don't change that. It is absolutely.
Yeah, and perhaps you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation in question one?
Did you get me?
Sorry. I didn't get you. Okay. That's just enough.
But, I mean, subject to consultation.
Yeah.
We need to hear.
No, it's subject to.
I would be more comfortable consulting about this in a DP than in an ED.
Yes.
Because it could kill an ED.
Yeah.
And
but it's quite a discreet thing to take out of an ED.
Exactly, it's very discreet.
It's a discreet piece.
That's true. But it might just spoil the atmosphere.
Already. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about. So I'm not so sure about the added value relative to the risk.
We haven't made that decision yet, have we?
No.
No. Okay, and so the second
but
part...
But if this would push me more in the line of, let's go for an EPS.
Sorry, this is really picking ahead, Hans. But alternatively, when we come to that decision, if the softness of our understanding about the area, you know, the reconciliation is the one piece that makes us go DP versus ED. Maybe we say pause and go out and, you know, specifically test that more extensively than taking soundings from consultative groups in order to make up our mind, rather than holding up the whole of something. That, you know, that's a discussion for later, but this may be isolated in terms of its state of development.
I voted yes, but really anticipating what Mary recommended, that because if we voted no, it's dead, right? And I do think we can do more learning. So I just want to, I think, get out that we had a lot of discussion about additional information we had to learn. So just for what it's worth, because I do, if we go and check it out and get sort of negative news back, then, you know, we should review it.
So are we going to do the DPET debate now? Or
No.
Let's not do it now then. Yeah, well, let's not.
But we might be able to get that.
We'll live with the consequences. Okay, question two.
Do you want to go through the other part of question one? Within question one, it was we went into a discussion in the paper about what we meant by calculated consistently.
And the staff are recommending that only the adjustments described in paragraph 10, and these are also described in the two bullet points in question one, should be made in calculating the numerator of adjusted EPS. So put it another way, that only those differences between the management performance measure and the most directly comparable IFRS subtotal would be differences between the numerator of adjusted EPS and the numerator of EPS. So noting that the latter adjustments may be after tax and NCI. So in other words, the adjusted EPS couldn't make additional adjustments. Let's say if you had an adjusted operating profit, the adjusted EPS couldn't then take in additional adjustments to finance costs, say. But it would just be limited to those adjustments of between the management performance measure and the directly comparable IFRS subtotal. Now, that was the staff interpretation of consistently calculated. Are board members happy with that?
I believe we are.
Yes.
So moving on to question two. As explained in the paper, we think a requirement to provide adjusted EPS might have limited benefit for users unless accompanied by disclosure of the effects of tax and NCI separately for each of the adjustments. Question two on page 11, does the board agree an entity shall disclose the effect of tax and NCI separately for each of the differences between the numerator of adjusted EPS and the numerator of EPS?
Do we assume now that we have yes on question one?
Because yes.
Yes on question two, even if I have said no on question one, because you have, I think, provides this information without this detail would not make any sense.
No, of course not.
So even.
Tak.
Thank you. To me, the question one, question two has a big difference. And in the case of question one, I think it's difficult to reach this number. However, the preparer can do it based on the using net amount, using the bottom line amount, and the total amount basis. So it's not 100%. It may not be 100% accurate, but it would be usable for this type of disclosure. However, when you require this kind of precise table for the reconciliation, then if the MPM is something like includes a lot of adjusted operating profit who adjust 3-4 items, then they have to go through each individual items. That substantially make the entity to do the proportionate consolidation, and that gives lots of burden to the preparers. So I do understand the necessity of reconciliation for the EPS to MPM EPS, but asking the table like paragraph 20 is a bit too much.
Ready to vote? Who supports the staff's recommendation?
Ten. Is that 10? So, if an entity discloses more than one management performance measure, it would be required to disclose more than one adjusted EPS under our proposals. However, we've listed two alternatives that we could consider if we think multiple adjusted EPS may be unhelpful or confusing in paragraph 25. So paragraph 25A is first just disclosing a single EPS figure if adjustments made in determining the different management performance measures are identical, except as a result of one MPM being determined further down the statement of financial performance than the other. Or secondly, we could change the requirement to only require disclosure of the effect of tax and NCI for each of the differences between the management performance measure and the most directly comparable IFRS subtotal, rather than the full EPS calculation. So does the board, question three on page 12 is, does the board agree if an entity has more than one management performance measure, the requirements for adjusted EPS would apply to all management performance measures? And does the board think we should explore either of the alternatives in paragraph 25?
Mary?
You know, I came into today's discussion supporting this, and just as I reflected on some of the comments about the potential complexity, about losing sight of the original simpler objective, you know, Morrow's caution in particular, et cetera, I think I'm coming much more back to either alternative B or something that I think somebody had as a throwaway line before, which was the, you know, the most inclusive measure, which is sounds easy and appealing now when we haven't thought about it. But, finding a way to say one, because I think if we start having these disaggregated by adjustment for X, you know, for 3 or 4X times, it's just going to take over the financial statements. So don't support the staff, you know, have turned around, don't support the staff recommendation and think we should look for a way to focus it on the one that would give the most information to users. On its face, alternative B seems more likely to do that.
Nick?
Yeah, I almost agree. almost. In that I think multiple adjusted EPS are distinctly unhelpful, unwelcome by the market. I suspect in practice we won't have many of them, but I think in theory the proposal allows for them. Or requires them, as Francois says. I would be more sympathetic to A, that feels like the more what's described as inclusive approach to me. But either way, I would like to find a way where we home down to one adjusted EPS number.
Jung-woo.
Thank you. Just could you explain that A in the paragraph 25? It seems quite difficult to understand what A means.
Paragraph 25A?
Yes.
It would just be if they had... at the moment, we would only allow the adjustments to adjusted EPS to be the same as the adjustments to the MPM. So you would have an adjusted EPS for every single MPM that you have. But say if you had an adjusted operating profit that only excluded restructuring costs, and say the other MPM was an adjusted profit that excluded the restructuring costs but also excluded other items as well, because other, say, financing items further down the income statement. If a company provided the adjusted EPS disclosure for that adjusted profit, that would also provide enough information about the tax and NCI effects of the adjustments made in the adjusted operating profit. So the MPM furthest down, providing adjusted EPS for the MPM furthest down the, or determined furthest down the income statement, would provide all the information about any of the others that are further up, provided that that measure lower down included all the adjustments that were made in the determining measures further up.
Still quite complex, but I'll try to understand. But so you asked, exploring the A or B for the further possible relief in future, right?
Yes, it would just if an entity had multiple management performance measures, that if it may provide some relief from some of the disclosures if it only had to provide the adjusted EPS measure for one of those measures, if that measure also provided sufficient information about the other measures.
All right. And final thing is, are there many cases that the companies publish this kind of multiple MPMs?
I think, well, under our proposals, I'm not sure if we were going for the best measure. I'm not sure if that would narrow scope down of these measures, but we are aware that there are some entities that are publishing adjusted operating profit, adjusted profit measures.
So I'm not so sure about how to vote for these questions, because the second question is sort of an alternative for the first question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what if we voted for, if the board doesn't want us to always require multiple EPSs if there are multiple MPMs, then I think what we'd need to do is to go away and to explore those two options further that are outlined in paragraph 25 as ways of giving relief on multiple MPMs.
I think that's probably where the board is leaning, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of inflicting multiple pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving to question four, on page 14. In light of concerns about some management performance measures being in the statement of financial performance, does staff think we should prohibit adjusted EPS in the statement of financial performance? Does the board agree?
Yeah.
I think we should include it.
going down this hole, let's get to the bottom.
All right. Question five.
That was unanimous. Yeah. Okay, and the final question on page 15. The staff think that if an adjusted EPS is provided on that's calculated on a different basis from the management performance measure, this could be confusing. So we think we should prohibit entities from disclosing an adjusted EPS that's not consistent with an identified management performance measure. Now, it might be that management considers adjusted EPS the measure of performance that best communicates to users the financial performance of the entity and has not identified a management performance measure. And in this case, we think the entity should really be identifying the numerator of adjusted EPS as an MPM. And then it would provide the management performance measure disclosure requirements for the numerator, including the adjusted EPS disclosures. So does the board agree that we should prohibit entities from disclosing other adjusted EPS measures other than those calculated consistently with a management performance measure?
Nick?
Thank you. I find the logic rather convoluted here. And if an entity felt that the adjusted EPS measure was its best or its appropriate measure of management performance, let that be its appropriate measure of management performance. The numerator isn't the same as the EPS number. If you'd been issuing share, I mean, the EPS number is actually more fully calculating your cost of capital. So if you issue more shares, you're going to have a lower EPS number. The numerator won't capture that in its own right. So I think it's legitimate for a company to say, just the EPS is our management performance number, rather than ask them to backward engineer it to work around this complication that we have.
Gary?
Thank you. This is a question I'm not even sure if it fits in any of the discussion we've had so far, but this is close of a place in the document that it does fit. What if, let's say, you know, earnings per share, you know, basic $1, and you wanted to disclose insider results, we had a restructuring charge of £100 million, and that was 5 cents a share. You're not adding it. You're just sitting inside income. Are you permitted to do that in here? How would I'm just putting the EPS on a transaction as opposed to a subtotal. How would that fit in all of this? It's like doing analysis. You know, it'd be something commonly found in MD&A. But it's very, very common. I don't add it. I don't pretend. I just tell you it's 5 cents a share. Where does that fit in all of this? What's that? I'm sorry?
So you're saying there, Gary, that what somebody's doing is they're presenting an amount per share, which is...
just on one event. Or something in my tax provision. We just lost an inland service revenue audit, and that cost us 5 cents a share. You know, doing an effective rate with and without the audit adjustment or the tax law changes, it's 5 cents a share. It's just a singular event that you put an EPS number on.
So it's amount per share rather than adjusted profit per share.
Well, you'd have an amount, you know, $100 million, you know, impairment charge, tax law change, whatever. And you do the math and say it's that affected earnings per share by 5 cents. Where does all that fit in here? And that is very, very common. Now, we might say it's out of scope and belongs in management commentary, but it's done all the time.
We've only looked at the adjusted profit in the paper, and so we haven't looked at other amounts per share, so they wouldn't our requirements wouldn't affect a company disclosing other amounts per share that aren't a post.
Well, this question didn't neatly fit in here and said, should we prohibit entities from disclosing other adjusted EPS? Now, that's not an adjusted, it's just an EPS effect of an event or a transaction. So could you do it under this or current IFRS?
I think our proposals wouldn't amount per share.
Yeah, our proposals wouldn't prevent you from having the amount per share. So the effect of this transaction is 5 cents per share. That would be permitted under our proposals. I think where you'd start to run into problems with our proposals would be if you said, well, our EPS is this, the effect of this amount per share is 5, and therefore our adjusted EPS is X minus 5, that's where I think you'd end up running foul of question 5 on our prohibition on disclosing additional EPSs that are not MPS.
No, but that's just adding two disclosed numbers together. I mean, it seemed to me you should be permitted to do that if you wanted to. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but if there's two numbers there, a dollar in the first sentence and 5 cents as a result of a singular transaction, you certainly, Nick and his colleagues could add it, and you could do it yourself, you know. But I'm here, so I think it's, again, it doesn't neatly fit in this discussion, but it's certainly relevant, you know, to, because you're ultimately, they're wanting you to look at the $5 in that example, as opposed to the dollar, which is the bottom line number. It's more common than you probably think.
Martin.
And I also don't agree, because you can see a situation where you have a management performance measure, let's assume it's a pre-tax number excluding restructuring. Then you have a one-term effect like a U.S. tax reform, which only affects your tax income number. And maybe you want to adjust your EPS based on this one big tax reform number, which we then would prohibit, and I would not agree to that. What I want to say is there can be situations where it makes a lot of sense and very useful for investors to get this kind of EPS impact, and therefore we should not prohibit that.
Harry.
I agree with Martin's point, and I think I'd go back to the point Nick made, and rather than trying to introduce a prohibition, saying that if the entity has an adjusted EPS figure that is not just an EPS expression of a management performance measure, then the entity needs to consider whether that adjusted EPS figure is itself a management performance measure. I think that's the point we're trying to get to. And that contrasts with the situation that Martin was just describing, which says it's not something I use every time because I don't have U.S. tax reform every year. But this year, I'm trying to express in EPS form as well the effect of a one-off. And I don't think we should do something that raises questions about it. And frankly, if I look at what you reprinted from IS 33, what's here is paragraph A2, A3, is making the point that if you disclose either that 5 cents per share number that Gary was talking about or the dollar a share net of the 5 adjustment, here's what you have to do to do it. So it would mean we'd be directly reversing something that's explicitly allowed now. And I just don't know that we have enough evidence that there's a problem with that we should look at revising it.
Relevant to this, we have to think about when an entity discloses something like an EPS common currency. So they've made a common currency EPS, so there's an adjusted EPS.
Constant currency?
A constant currency, adjusted EPS, and that sits by itself. And then somewhere else in their materials, they have an MPM, but they've chosen not to do an adjusted EPS in relation to that MPM. So we just got to think about that. So in relation to question 5, I would vote that we shouldn't prohibit, because there'll be these entities that have some reason to adjust EPS. It's got nothing to do with what they're doing with MPMs.
Tom? Sue, and then vote.
This is getting more complex all the time. Just so, one of the things, the first question, the sentence in paragraph 30 that starts, it says, the staff think that if an adjusted EPS is calculated on a different basis from the MPM, that might be confusing for users. And so what I'm hearing is you may essentially want to, that the EPS can be the MPM, is what people are sort of, some people are saying. So, and it kind of what Nick was even saying, there may be a case where you don't want to go way up for the thing. You may just want to disclose the EPS. And so I guess my first thing is, are we answering a question where there is an MPM and an EPS that is allegedly related to that MPM? Or are we doing a case where there might be one MPM that's up the income statement somewhere and another MPM that's done an EPS form that is not directly related to that MPM? Because if it's the latter, I think we don't have a problem. I'm coming back to the, there's a clear linkage in that first sentence, is that the adjusted EPS is ostensibly linked to that MPM. So does it, and kind of what Anne was just saying, or what Martin was saying, is if it's a standalone, independent management performance measure, does that just solve the problem? And it's okay to do it at the EPS level if that's the best way.
Sue?
I think what I'm going to say is consistent with where Tom's heading, what others have said, because I think we need to be careful we don't turn this into an earnings per share project, because then, you know, there's loads more broad questions, some of which Gary and others are alluding to, I think, where EPS is used. And I think, if I understand correctly, our main objective here is to make sure that if somebody is using one of these metrics, which they say is important, the management performance measure, that users of financial statements understand the adjustments that go with that, that then flow into the EPS calculation. And we just want to make sure that there's a logical flow and you can understand and you can make these adjustments that Nick said of people might want to make, where they want to add back some things management have taken out. If we stick to that being our objective in terms of the consistency of things, I think I wouldn't go beyond it to start talking more generally about prohibiting other things to do with EPS, because I think that's a bigger project.
Ponsard?
Well, having heard everything I've heard, I want to modify the view I had prepared on the basis of this paper. When I read this paper, the prohibition that the staff was recommended seemed to me as a logical consequence of the other proposals. And when I hear all the obstacles to approving that, I understand them. But I think there is an element that we had started from, which was that we were considering performance measures. And so we had reduced the population of elements. So I'm wondering whether this prohibition would not be, I mean, would not still make sense where I don't know whether population is the right word, but when the it would apply to the EPS would be a reflection of another performance measure, which is not none of the cases that have been taken as examples of why they should remain allowed. Because, I mean, there must be an internal consistency in this if we pursue it. So we require EPS when there is a management performance measure. We say it should not trouble the users, so we provide all the elements that in tax NCI that allows users to know what we're talking about, and all of a sudden we allow or we don't prohibit that an EPS that would come from nowhere and would still be having the purpose of being the reflection of performance measure would be allowed without any form of reconciling item, without any supplementary information. So to me there is something that doesn't hold together.
So if I understand you correctly, Francoise, you're differentiating between a situation like, I don't know, Martin had the example of, I'm trying to project what the effect of the change in tax would be, so that's got a different objective, as opposed to a situation where somebody's come along and already told us these are their management performance metrics that they care about, these are all the adjustments, and this is the EPS. And by the way, in addition to all of that, here's a different picture of our performance.
I think this is all getting frightfully complicated. I'm getting increasingly nervous about this paper, I must say. So can I see who supports the status recommendation in question five?
Zero.
No longer is
not the only nervous one. Okay, thank you.
Before closing, just for the record, for the clarity of the voting.
Well, that was pretty clear.
Because it's pretty clear, I just would like to clarify. Because in the first vote, we made a decision. And the second, when we made a second vote, Martin said, with the presumption that the first vote is we agreed to the first vote, and the second vote is made in that way. But the outcome of the second vote was different from what I was expecting when I vote for the first question. So maybe there is some possibility that I might have different voting if the second question was no. So just I'm raising the issue just for the fairness and for the record. So I'm not going to change the vote, by the way.
But you don't want to carry the responsibility for it. Yes.
but the voting mechanism is really difficult. So because
we're in a hole, Tanka, and you're digging it deeper and deeper.
It's okay because the only vote that was closed was the first vote.
Yeah.
Everything else was such a wide margin that one vote wouldn't change it. All the other.
Except the first one.
Okay,
And so, but if I'm right, Tack, that you voted against the proposal in question one.
No, I'm not going to change now. But because the question is difficult. If it was asked in the combination with question one and question two, with the precise as question two basis, I would have voted against. I might have. But now I'm not going to change the vote now. However, because when you make a presentation and taking a vote, that should be clarified. Because if it were as precise as question two, I might have voted against the question one. So I'm not changing the vote.
So the staff knows that it only has seven real votes. And the chairman, who has a double vote, when against.
Yeah. But just I'm raising it because it's quite difficult to answering the vote. Yeah.
Okay. Well, at least you got through the first. You want to bring this back or?
No.
All right, we take a 15-minute break.